Hello, and welcome to Yes Indeed Pod, a podcast about indie tabletop role-playing games, where I interview creators about their games and inspirations, and about the theory, process, and practice of game design. My name is Mark Shepherd, your host today and always, and your friendly local indie enthusiast. Thanks for bearing with me through the slight delays to my usual schedule. Sometimes life comes at you fast. Hopefully things will slow down a little bit from next week, but in these trying times of crisis and universal brouhaha, who can say? This week, I'm talking to game designer Paul Sager, veteran of the Forge and somebody whose insight and wisdom is still respected in the scene. He's one of my favourite designers, and I'm so excited for you to hear our interview. Now that's out of my head and into yours, let's talk indie. So today we're talking to Paul Sager. Hi there, Paul.
Hello.
Paul, could you take a minute just to introduce yourself and tell us what you do in the indie tabletop role-playing game space?
Sure. So yeah, I'm Paul Sager. I design tabletop role-playing and storytelling games. And I've been doing it for, I did it in high school, but I never published anything. I've been doing it seriously in a way that I'm making things available to people out there on the internet since the early 2000s.
Yeah, it's an impressive back catalog. Do you want to tell us some of the stuff that you've made in the past?
Sure. If your listeners have heard of me, it's probably because of my game, My Life with Master, which I published in 2003. It won the Diana Jones Award. It's the first thing I ever published and charged money for. You play the minions of a horrific master, and it has a narrative arc that plays out in 3 to 5 sessions, and that results in the death of the master. And the thing that made it different and that caught everybody's attention was that it treated the end of play as a creative destination. Before that, everybody wanted campaign play. That's the one people might have heard of. I have another game from 2014 that I ran a Kickstarter for called The Clay That Woke. That one's a diceless system. It has a token drawing system. The player characters are nameless minotaurs in a civilization that's declining, or that it's in decline from a prior era of greatness. And you play these minotaurs. They have a code of life conduct they adhere to. And they have, there are different archetypes. There's a philosopher minotaur archetype and an advocate and a soldier and a leader archetype. And there are different interactions that they have with each other to be effective. And maybe the society that you're in will enter into a new era of greatness or not.
Yeah, certainly that's one of the games that I saw first from yourself, and I was very taken with because it's beautifully written, beautifully drawn, it's very clever, and the themes that it deals with and the themes that it talks about are smart, and I feel like they were sort of ahead of their time in a way. Somebody described it to me the other day as OSR before OSR was a thing. I don't know if that sort of matches your vision of what that game was about.
Yeah, so my inspirations for that game are the role-playing game Jeroen, which has this really rich setting and a very multicultural in a way, and it has a, you know, the setting has this sort of, you know, feels like it's lasted forever. You know, it has this long stretch of cultural history to it.
Yeah.
And I really liked the Gene Wolfe Earth of the New Sun books, the Shadow of the Torturer and the Claw of the Conciliator. That particular series also has a very sort of rich setting.
Right, yeah.
I wanted to do that. There was a conversation way back at the Forge about the idea that you can create a role-playing game where the player characters are really rich, fleshed-out characters. But if you do that, you want the setting to be kind of sketchy because the material you're dealing with is the characters. But the flip side is also true, that you can create a role-playing game with a rich setting, but then if you try and put really rich characters into it, it can be creative overload.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So you can create a rich setting and then have sketchy characters to start with. And that was sort of the underlying thought around the way the game is put together. Your Minotaur character, it takes you moments to create. You pick your character archetype and that tells you what your starting stats are, and it gives you a starting supply of tokens, and that's pretty much it. I mean, you're ready to go. You're a nameless Minotaur. You're working a job that you didn't get to choose for yourself.
Yeah.
And encountering the game world.
That whole mechanic about putting tokens into a central location and then drawing them out again, I think younger me, when I first read it, was kind of blown away. Like, it was such a different way of doing things than all of the role-playing games that I'd seen before. Yeah. It was just one of those moments which kind of, I think, defined the way that I thought about games. I love that book. I love the way it's drawn, everything. Just think it's wonderful. And if you haven't seen it before, then you must go and see it because it's wonderful.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing quickly. That particular token drawing mechanic was inspired by a board game called Claustrophobia.
Okay.
Have you played Claustrophobia?
I haven't, no, but I'm fascinated that it came from a board game, and now I can, it's a very board gamey mechanic, isn't it? Like,
I mean, it's really adapted from that, but in the board game, it's a miniatures based thing, and there are tiles on the table, and your miniatures have an objective to escape while they're being attacked by, you know, opponents. And it's a two player game, and the game master role, or the opposition role, the monster role, they have a chart that they can buy adversity off of based on dice rolls.
Right.
So if you roll 2 sevens, or if you roll, you know, all odds, or all, you know what I mean? So you're sort of looking at what you rolled, and it's like, do I want to use this dice roll to buy this option or that option? So the early draft of The Clay That Woke, I wanted it to be a buying option where, you know, the tokens you drew out, and then you would look and see if you could buy the, outcomes that you wanted.
Yeah.
But it ended up evolving into more of an oracle where you kind of go down the shopping list in order and you get the first outcome you can afford.
Yeah.
But it was inspired by that game. The other thing I would say is that, I mean, you've talked about how much you like the book. And I, you know, when I think about what I'm doing as a game designer, the thing I really need to accomplish is I really need to inspire people to want to play the game.
Yeah.
That's the big challenge. You know, if my mechanics are imperfect, you know, if there are design flaws in the game, it doesn't matter as much as if I can figure out how to inspire people to play, and then they'll overcome that stuff. So The Clay That Woke was really me thinking about this whole landscape of fantasy role-playing games that nobody ever plays. And they all have sort of common characteristics to them. They're, you know, they start with a section about character creation. Maybe they have some example of play text scattered around. You know, they've got a whole section of the creatures in the game world. And, you know, they have a section on game mastering at the end. And they're all sort of organized in that way. And, you know, I felt like if I write a game and I organize it in that same way, like a textbook, and nobody plays it, then it's a missed opportunity, you know, to have tried to be inspiring in some other way.
Yeah.
So I wrote The Clay That Woke, the text of it. You know, I wanted it to hook people and just draw them through the whole thing. There's a game called Earth Dawn from the 90s. And it's got a rich setting. It's got complicated characters. And if you sit down to play that game and you're not really familiar with the game world, the players have to figure out how to be educated about the game world. And that's hard.
Right.
When they published that game, they published a series of novels, a trilogy, you know, I think to try to inspire people to read them and understand the game world and then play the game. In the same way that if you play a Star Wars game, everybody has the context of understanding Star Wars because they've seen the movies.
Yeah.
It's the greatest asset that the Star Wars role-playing game has is the fact that the movies exist, so that everybody knows what the themes are and everybody knows what the world is like and what's an appropriate action for a bounty hunter to take and what's not. And the thing is, with Earth Dawn, it didn't work. Nope. You know, only game masters ever read the novels. The players never read all the novels. It just, you know, they just wanted to play the game.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to write something that I hoped somebody would start reading it and it would pull them through the game text. They'd get fiction entwined with game mechanics, entwined with setting information. And, you know, by the time they got to the end, they would have internalized everything they needed to know. They'd understand the game world. They'd understand the mechanics well enough to be able to play a character, and it would be a fun reading experience all the way through.
You can see that when you read it, that what you're trying to do is not write a game text, you know, a manual of how to play the game. You are writing a lot of things all in together, and it does, yeah, it pulls you through. It lets you understand what your writing process was and your design process was in a way. It lets you understand what the themes and the mechanics of the game are at the same time, which is not easily achieved and is not done widely enough in indie role-playing games at all. It's funny that you mentioned Earthdawn. The way that you've described that is exactly how I feel about big games like Shadowrun. Like, I feel like you need to know a lot about Shadowrun before you can even play it, which is, like, that doesn't work for me. Not at all. I prefer my settings to be, as you said, either very rich with scant characters or very scant with rich characters. Yeah, I think it's a great text.
So I've written another game. It's called Traverser. And the reason it's not out there is because it needs the same kind of text as The Clay That Woke does.
Right.
It needs a text where the mechanics and the setting information and fiction are entwined together and do the same thing to pull the reader through the text.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to write that. It's the best game I've designed, and yet, you know, I have to figure out how to get myself into the headspace where I can write another text like that, and that's really hard.
Yeah. That sounds really cool. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I will. It's a game that's kind of getting away from me in a way. I started designing it in, I think it was 2015. It was 5 years ago. It was on the heels of The Clay That Woke. And, you know, I thought after The Clay That Woke that maybe somebody else would be inspired to create a similar kind of game text. And they hadn't. And I just couldn't, you know, get it out of my head. And so I came up with the idea for Traverser. The player characters are women ex-soldiers from a corporate war. So it's a science fiction game.
Yeah.
And it takes place after reality breaks. Reality tears itself apart and then stitches itself back together. And it's kind of like reality giving a gift to humanity, because it's better after that. There are no prisons. There's no common currency, no central government. And the player characters were soldiers in this corporate war.
Yeah.
And they had quantum reality powers. And when reality breaks itself apart and stitches itself back together, the whole context for that war is just gone. So they take the quantum technology out of them and just cut them loose. But they still have their quantum reality powers, except now when they use them, there are consequences. Like, their history can be edited, parallel realities, that things didn't happen the way they thought they happened or the way they remember them happening.
Right.
And so you end up, as you're playing, you end up holding this sort of mental representation of the character in your mind as, you know, becomes complicated, because who are they really? Are they who they think they are? Are they not? You become this sort of complicated character with multiple paths.
Yeah, different timelines and alternate versions of oneself. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the best game I've ever designed.
It sounds amazing.
The core mechanic for it is it's a card-based, diceless mechanic, and it's emotionally productive in ways like I have never designed in another game. You're making choices with each other and then comparing cards. You're making blind choices. And when you agree, you know, you and the game master feel this connection. You know, you're interpreting the fiction the same way. You want it to go the same way. You want the same outcome.
Yeah.
And it feels like nothing else you've ever played.
Okay.
You'll realize when you play it that all other games are about disagreement in some way or another.
Yeah.
The game master is setting some target number, you know, or the game master is creating challenge for you or opposition for you.
Right.
But this is about agreement. This is about feeling like you both want it to go the same way. And it has strategic elements as well. So it's not totally like, hey, do we agree on this kind of thing? If you feel like you disagree, you can still win and get the outcome you want, not the one the game master wants.
Right.
You know, like I said, it's sort of starting to get away from me. I haven't written the text, but I ran two sessions of it for GauntletCon a few years ago.
Yeah.
And one of those players asked me if he could have my draft rules so that he could run it for the Gauntlet at some point. And then a player who played in it when he ran it asked me if he could have my draft and if he could run it. You know, he's run it several times now.
Yeah.
And I've never had that happen to me before with a game. I mean, usually you publish a game and then you have to figure out how to promote it and get people to know it exists and want to put in the time to learn it and run it. And this is very different for me to have, you know, people are trying to figure out how to run it from my, you know, very, very imperfect text. So I really need to figure out how to write it, because it's escaping me, you know, without me having written it.
For sure. I mean, if it's the kind of thing, again, which is going to be intertwined fiction and text and metatext and all of that running through a single thread for a book, then yeah, that sounds like it's going to be a challenge to write that needs focus.
Yeah, and focus is hard during the pandemic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can do stuff in dribs and drabs, but that kind of writing needs a lot of focus.
Yeah.
I launched a Kickstarter in February for a choose your own adventure story, and it was mostly written at that point. It's called We're Just Friends, and it's the story of, you know, the ancient Greek and Roman gods and goddesses. They had a whole bunch of them that never had any myths written about them. They just appear on pottery, you know, or they appear in some cosmological origin story because they conceptually represent something that the writer thought was an important aspect of the cosmos.
Yeah.
But there's no myths about them.
Yeah.
And this is about one of them that have no myths about her. Her name is Philotes, and she's the goddess of romantic friendship, or at least that's my interpretation of who she is.
Yeah.
And this is a choose your own adventure story about her and whether she's going to achieve her potential as a goddess in the modern era. You know, is this her time? You know, is she going to do what it takes? You know, I had 80% written and I was supposed to deliver it this summer. Being able to finish it is hard. So I just had to apologize to my Kickstarter backers saying, you know, I've done little onesie twosie small games on itch.io over the past few months, but that's a different kind of, I can do that in between helping my son with his remote learning. And, you know, the texts don't have to be perfect. I don't have to be in a flow when I'm writing them.
Yeah.
But this I do. So that's another writing project. And that one I got to finish too.
It's in a stack.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds really cool. And I hope that you can get around to it soon and have it out there, because I would genuinely love to see it. I think it sounds amazing, especially if it's like The Clay That Woke, which I do often cite as one of my big inspirations. So a while back there, you mentioned something about The Forge, and your name is one that's often linked to The Forge as it was back in the day. Do you want to tell people about what it was like to be part of that movement?
Yeah. So did you know Bill White?
By reputation.
Bill's writing a book about The Forge. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. Great.
He's writing it for an academic press. So if you want like the PDF, I think it's $90 or something like that. So he interviewed me for that. The book starts off and Bill's having a conversation with Michael S. Miller, who was also a participant at The Forge. He designed a game called With Great Power. Michael's wife is the one who invented Games on Demand. So Bill and Michael are at a convention together and they're having a conversation. And Michael says something like, people are starting to forget about The Forge. And Bill says, oh, geez, you know, and starts thinking and decides to write a book about it. So it's his effort to instantiate the legacy of The Forge. And he interviewed me for that book. I'll tell you the quick version of everything that I told him. I was nothing before The Forge, really. It was the end of the 90s. You know, everybody thought that role-playing games were a solved problem. You wrote them a certain way. You published them a certain way.
Yeah.
Core book followed by splat book, by splat book, by splat book. You know, you hired freelancers. If you wanted to work in the hobby, you started off as a freelancer writing splat book content. The game mechanics were, you know, stat plus skill against the target number. Maybe it was a die pool, maybe it wasn't. That was what a character looked like. You know, you had a multi-page character with stat plus skill, game mechanics. Every game text had this rule zero thing in there that, oh, you know, if the mechanics don't work for you, you can change them, do what makes sense kind of a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and then the Forge said there is a lot more possibility than that. If your education is the games of the 90s, that's a narrow education because there's so much more possibility than that.
Right. Yeah.
That particular message is the legacy of the Forge. I mean, that's what unlocked me. You know, it made me realize that game design was my creative medium and that I could create games like My Life with Master that thought, you know, differently about everything. You know, I mean, you create the antagonist together. The end of play is your creative destination and you're working toward it. You know, and that it doesn't have to be about combat. It's about something else. You know, I mean, the essence of the Forge to me back then was it felt like, you know, almost like a research community. You know, everybody was, you know, hunting GeoCities for games that somebody had posted as a web page and playing them.
Yeah.
And then coming back to the Forge and posting and saying, hey, we played this game and it was, we thought it was crazy, but it was fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were figuring out how human creativity intersected with different social architectures for play. And sometimes I call role-playing games social architectures because, you know, you're structuring collaboration and the creative material that you're using, the themes that are present in the game.
Yeah.
The Forge felt like everybody bringing their findings back.
Yeah, yeah.
If you read Bill's book, there's all sorts of toxic stuff that happens, you know, tone policing in the discussion forums. You know, people were definitely harmed by aspects of the Forge. But I think the best legacy of the Forge is stuff like games on demand. We did a booth at Gen Con, the Forge booth at Gen Con. You know, if you went to Gen Con and you were going to, and you wanted to demo a role-playing game before the Forge booth, you had to sign up. You know, you'd go to the booth, there'd be a sign-up sheet. You know, they were going to run a 4-hour demo at 4 o'clock. They had room for 8 people or something like that.
Yeah.
Or they had it on the convention schedule, or they had table space somewhere where you could go and, you know, play it in the convention hall somewhere. But you were looking at playing a 4-hour thing. And the Forge booth said, why don't we figure out how to make quick demos in the booth, you know?
Yeah.
And people would come up and, you know, you'd say, would you like to demo anything? And they were into it.
Yeah, that does sound rad.
It was easy to get somebody to commit, you know, 20, 25 minutes to a demo in the booth. And Michael S. Miller's wife, Kat Miller, she saw that and she's, and people wanted to keep playing. So what she realized was, you know what? People at Gen Con, when they've got a time gap, they would love to just walk up and say, I would love to play something right now. And I am wide open to what I might play.
Yeah.
So she realized that games on demand, we could do it. You know, we could do 4-hour time slots and people would just walk up with a generic ticket and pick a game off of a whiteboard and say, The Shadow of Yesterday, I'll play The Shadow of Yesterday. You know, I'll play, you know, Dust Devils, or I'll play My Life with Master. And that's an enormous legacy of the Forge.
Yeah.
You know, it started off, Games on Demand was in a hotel that was apart from the convention center. And they were bringing in so many generic tickets and there was so much energy that Gen Con moved it into the main convention center, into the hallway right above the dealer hall, because it was such a big draw for so many people. There were people who go to Gen Con, spend their whole time at Games on Demand.
It sounds like a wonderful space. And it does sound like a big scene, you know, a big mood in what would have been happening. To me, what it really sounds like is that Forge and Games on Demand around Gen Con and stuff would have been, I don't know what the indie scene was like prior to then, but if it was just a lot of people working in isolation and not really being able to connect, then it sounds like the Forge is kind of a seminal moment in how the indie scene moved forward from that point. And that sounds very much the kind of thing that I'm interested in reading about, because I love indie. That's what I do. So
the indie scene before the Forge was some gamer who decided they wanted to create a game. You know, they design it, they figure out how to do this traditional print run of 3,000 copies, and they figure out how to afford a booth at Gen Con, which was cost a fortune, or Origins, and they show up there with nobody knows who they are, you know?
Yeah.
And they hope to sell some copies and create some energy. They've got their one core book sitting there on the table. You know, maybe somebody went to the Gamma Trade Show, which was in, used to be in Las Vegas before Gen Con, with their game to try and create some market awareness. You know, maybe they bought some ads somewhere, but really people weren't selling PDFs online. You know, they were trying to publish their game in the way that they thought the game publishers did it. You know, they weren't breaking the rules. Lulu Press didn't exist. You know, you couldn't do this sort of have your game sitting up on the internet for print on demand for anybody who wanted it.
Yeah, there was no Lulu, there was no DTRPG. You know, these spaces did not exist accessibly at the time.
And the discussion forums, there weren't design conversations in online discussion forums. They were dominated more by game fans than designers.
Yeah.
The Forge is absolutely a turning point in gaming. It totally is.
It's kind of a shame that we don't have that game design space. Where people talk about game design now on Twitter, it's a different kind of mood, I imagine. there are voices out there, people who would talk about their process and their game design, but I feel like it's not the same thing. Yeah, sometimes I lament that I was not around earlier.
You know, like I said, you know, to me, it felt like a collective research project. And I think that's the element that's missing. You know, if you follow Epidaya on Twitter, you know, he tweets about his game design efforts. You know, people sort of sound off about what they're doing as a designer, but there's not this sort of concerted research project where groups are playing games experimentally, trying things out, and then bringing their findings back to a discussion forum. And,
yeah,
you know, they're figuring out human creativity and, you know, and storytelling. And it's as simple as, you know, if I'm playing a storytelling game and I turn over a card and it's a prompt for something that I have to do in the game, is that prompt fun or not fun? Is it frustrating or is it fun?
Yeah.
You know, if I do enough of that, I can figure out a pattern that makes sense to me and try and make a game around that.
Yeah.
And you, that's the activity that you don't see now, is the experimentation. And that's the part that I missed the most.
I think you're right. And like, to a certain extent, Itch helps to fill that space a little bit, because people produce things on there that are small and experimental. And by virtue of putting it out there and people discussing it and putting reviews on there, then yeah, there is a kind of parallelism to what the original intent of, or what the original outcomes of that research program were. Yeah, it's not the same thing. And I think it's a thing that indie would really need and tabletop role-playing games would really benefit from.
As a creator, a lot of my energy is contrary energy. You know, I see a game and I think, man, that was a missed opportunity. I could do better than that, you know? Or I see a game and I'm frustrated by some aspect of it. My Life with Master was absolutely born out of frustration with what I thought were, you know, a narrow way of looking at games. You know, the games of the 90s felt, you know, narrow to me. And My Life with Master had a lot of, you know, it was my sort of contrary energy that sort of took me, you know, through the process of designing it and getting it done.
Right.
The thing I see about Itch is it's also driven by a lot of contrary energy.
Yeah.
Designers are creating things on Itch that, you know, they're a poke in the eye to the post-Forge style of indie tabletop game or storytelling game. You know, they're, you know, rituals of imagining yourself as a character, but without any narrative bolted onto them. Or they're,
yeah,
you know, whereas, you know, narrative arc was a big deal in the Forge era design scene, but you can find tons of games on Itch that have, you know, no aspiration to deliver anything that's even close to a story.
Yeah.
It's imagining your identity or expressing it in a certain way.
Yeah. And I talked to Georgie Batts a few weeks ago, and Georgie has not been in role-playing games very long. And their whole shtick is writing poetry games, is writing lyric games. And this kind of lyric game movement where you are very loosely attaching mechanics to poetry or mechanics to storytelling and barely even doing that. Yeah, it feels very counter to some of the theory that I've seen come out of the Forge era. I just think that's a really interesting contradiction, and it's interesting what you're saying about it being contrary energy. That's kind of fascinating.
I appreciate the contrary energy. I mean, I feel a great deal of connection to that. I think it's hard to find yourself as a creator if your contrary energy is, you know, only a year and a half old. You know, it's hard to be 22 years old and a game designer driven by contrary energy. So a lot of people, you know, they might talk about, you know, their Itch games as, you know, this is a reading experience. I mean, for me, there is nothing else like tabletop role-playing games as a creative medium.
Yeah.
Because a role-playing game is a set of instructions that you expect the playgroup to follow.
Yeah.
And there is a whole audience conditioned to follow those instructions.
Yeah.
Tabletop gamers are used to being given instructions and following them.
Yeah.
And that's not like any other art form.
No.
That's not like music or being a novelist. You know, a novelist doesn't tell you what actions to take and then you take them. You know, tabletop games are unique in that way and powerful in that way.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, a young designer who's saying, hey, you don't even have to play this game. I can appreciate the contrarian energy of that, saying, hey, I'm designing things that look like you might play them, but you don't have to play them. They're reading experiences. They're expressive.
Yeah.
But I think you're throwing out the, you know, the real power of the medium. By having that be your contrarian energy, if that is your contrarian energy, I think your contrarianism is focused on the wrong thing.
Yeah, I suppose it would be like a painter saying you don't have to look at my paintings, or a musician saying, hey, it's okay just to buy my CDs to look at, something like that.
Yeah,
I'm sure there are a lot of musicians who would probably say that, actually. But, you know, in some sense, the kind of the experimentation is interesting. But I think I take what you're saying about it's not, you know, you're missing the point. You're throwing the baby out with the bathwater by saying, don't play my games, just read them.
Yeah,
but that's interesting.
I'm a contrarian designer. I love contrarian energy, you know, but that particular contrarianism seems like it's missing the real power of the art form.
Absolutely. I feel like we've had some interesting conversations there. There's a lot that your experience can lend to the scene. And yeah, thanks very much for saying it all.
Well, thanks for having me on.
No problem. Paul, do you want to tell us where we can find you on the internet and what projects you might have coming up in the next few months?
Sure. My primary website is halfmeme.com, halfmeme.com. I sell games on Itch.io as well, and you can find me pretty easily. It's paulsega.itch.io. And I tend not to cross the streams on those. I tend to treat Itch.io as a separate project of super experimental stuff and stuff that's all sort of, I don't know, just trying to push the boundaries. And it's more of a window into who I am as a designer trying to figure out what's possible. People say, hey, wait a minute, why can't I find your games from Itch.io on halfmeme.com? And it's like, you know, they're sort of separate projects to me.
Yeah.
And I've used Kickstarter as well in the past for projects. The Clay That Woke was a Kickstarter project, and We're Just Friends is a recent Kickstarter project. And I'm on Twitter at Paul Sega.
Yeah. Brilliant. So that sounds like a good place where you should go and check Paul out and Paul's work, because his voice is always interesting to hear from. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you very much for coming on Yes Indeed Pod, and I hope to hear from you again in the future.
Thanks. You know, anytime.
No problem. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Paul for the interview. As always, you can find all of the links in the episode description. Next week, I'll be talking to Francita, Hector and Brent of the Creators Catalyst Project, which provides layout, illustration and professional editing services to marginalised creators trying to publish their games. It's all crowdfunded from the indie community, and its success is a fantastic sign of the scene's health. Tune in next time to find out more. You can still get the first issue of the Indie Zine on Itch.io and DriveThruRPG, and until the 1st of November, it's the same base price of just $4 on both platforms. That money is a direct vote of confidence in the indie scene and is so, so appreciated. It also just happens to net you 9 original games, 4 interesting articles, and 4 useful supplements, as well as #6moves to your PBTA or BOB games based on characters from Les Miserables. Blimey! Please go and check it out. If you enjoy Yes Indeed Pod, please rate and review the show wherever you find your podcasts, or consider donating through the Ko-Fi page at ko-fi.com/yesindeedpod. Of course, you can always reach out to me through Twitter at IamPhoPhos. That's IamPhoPhos. I'd love dearly to hear from you. Lastly, music credits. All music is from BitQuest by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and Filmmusic.io. Thanks, Kevin. Until next time, remember, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.